This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Welcome to another episode of Junk Food Cinema here on FilmSchoolRejects.com. This is, of course, the weekly cult and exploitation film cast that is so good, it just has to be fattening. I am your host, Brian Salisbury, and joining me, as always, is my friend and co-host. He's a novelist. He's a screenwriter. He is Lieutenant of Megaforce, Mr. C. Robert Cargill.
Yes.
How are things?
Great. We are doing an epic two-parter. Our first epic two-parter.
Yes.
Like we have done, you know, theme months before, and yeah, we've recorded, you know, several episodes at a time, but never about the same series like this.
Oh, this is a franchise so nice we decided to visit it twice in 2 weeks.
Yeah, well, I mean, the thing is, and here is what's really fascinating about this this series, is if you were to make a Junk Food Cinema League of Super Friends.
Yes.
Like, if you were to sit down and go, okay, I'm going to make a movie series with some of the greatest actors in the Junk Food Cinema pantheon, you would end up casting half of the league from these movies.
Oh, hell yes.
Like,
hell
these,
yes.
These are people, like, we're talking about a movie tonight that we've got one of the greatest detectives of the 80s.
Boom.
We've got Ash.
Boom.
We've got Shaft.
Oh, shit.
And we've got Robert Zadar.
Oh, the face and the chin in one movie together.
Yes, so and that's just one movie. Mm-hmm. And then when you move on through this series, every movie is like, oh, hey, yeah, by the way, here's another series of people that you would totally put in the League of Super Friends. Now, not two has one in particular, and three has two, but we're not going to talk about three.
And what movies are we talking about? What franchise are we talking about? Well, we're going to have to plead the fifth on that for just a moment, while we remind you that this show is available on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. You can also find us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema, and like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. All that being said, we have the right to remain silent about these movies, but we're not gonna. We're gonna waive that right big time, because this week we are talking about Maniac Cop.
There is something in the streets.
Hey!
Something in the shadows. Something in the dark. That kills.
You think a cop did this?
Why not?
Do you automatically assume that it was a police officer instead of some lunatic son of a bitch dressed up like a cop?
He strikes without cause. Without mercy.
Who's he killing? Who's yours? That's yours.
Innocent people.
Maniac cop?
He may be getting information from inside the department.
That means he is one of us.
When a cop turns killer, no one is safe.
Yes.
Oh my God, I am so excited to talk. This has been one of my deep pride favorites since the day I moved to Austin. It's a movie that I'd heard about just kind of through the grapevine of the internet long ago and far away, and never got a chance to see. And then pretty much as soon as I moved here, I tracked it down. And oh my dear sweet junkie Jesus. Like, this film is, it's so much fun, and it's this strange combination of all these elements of all these different weird subgenres mashed into one thing.
Yeah, and actually, I would say mashed into two things that are one thing. Because here's why we're doing this two-parter. Both of these films are entertaining as hell.
Truth.
Both of these films are to be held up in the pantheon of Junk Food Cinema classics. And both of these films are actually half of a film.
Huh.
They're both an hour and a half long. They both fit everything you need for the structure of a movie to be able to sit down and watch it as its own. But each movie only has half of the movie. The first movie, the one we're talking about tonight, is almost incomplete. Like, it has everything you need to watch from beginning to end and be like, I just watched a movie. But it doesn't have everything.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have the real motivation of what's going on with our villain. You don't have a real conclusion with our villain. You don't have all of the backstory that you needed as to what really happened. You need both films for that. And each film has just enough and is leanly made to keep you into what you want to fucking watch, which is a maniac fucking cop going berserk. But ultimately, you need to watch both of them, and you should watch both of them back to back.
Did you know that in a completely accidental fashion, you just compared Maniac Cop as a series, at least in the first two films, to The Godfather, which is another movie where you get almost all the information you need in the first one, and then in the second one you get more of the backstory, and then there's this additional story going on. But you could do like the Godfather saga cut of Maniac Cop and put both of the films together and air that as one movie.
Oh yeah, easily.
Holy crap.
Yeah, and the only real major change you have to make is you have to cut out one repeated sequence in the second film.
Yes.
There's one sequence that is almost a shot-for-shot retooling of some footage from the first movie. You cut that out, and you can cut this film together and create a single 2-hour, 30-minute, 2-hour, 45-minute junkie classic.
Absolutely.
So let's talk about the interesting thing about this series is that from beginning to end, for all three movies, they are written and produced by the same guy.
And Mr. William Lustig.
No.
Oh, written Larry, and produced. Sorry. Yeah, written, Larry Cohen.
Mm-hmm. Who we will get into in a second. And then directed by William Lustig.
Correct.
The same director all the way through. Which is how this series has such consistency. And how these two films seem to work so well together. Despite there being a few differences, which we will discuss over the course of these episodes. Here's the thing is you need to know who both of these guys are, because they are, when it comes to the 80s, they are some of the sleaziest, junkiest, most entertaining writer and directors of the era. Larry Cohen, of course, is responsible for a number of schlocktastic movies. As a director, he's well renowned as one of the worst directors ever. Like, he is a director who has directed terrible movies, even entertaining movies. You're just like, oh my God. The ones in the 80s that he's most notorious and famous for are, of course, Cue the Winged Serpent, which is glorious, and The Stuff.
Yes.
Both of them are so enjoyable, but not because they're good. They are just the opposite of like Maniac Cop and some of his other stuff. But the thing is that Larry Cohen didn't just make junk.
No, he's actually responsible for one of my favorite blaxploitation movies of all time.
Oh,
Black
yeah.
Caesar.
Yeah. Didn't he also do Hell Up in Harlem?
He did the sequel Hell Up in Harlem as well.
So he goes back that far, but he also makes really good movies into the 2000s, having penned Phone Booth and Cellular, two movies about people trapped on phones.
Yeah, I think
flipped, and both really entertaining.
I think 2002 was the year that Larry Cohen discovered cellular phones. That just turned that into two different movies.
Yeah, and both really good movies. Like, those are really entertaining films. So he is not one of those guys who you can just write off as being some schlock master. He's not he's not someone like Charles Band.
No, he's more like Roger Corman.
Yes. But he's so smart.
Yeah.
And here in this movie, we see just how smart he is. He does something. He breaks a lot of rules throughout his movies. And a lot of times it seems like he does it He does it indirectly. Like, he's just like, fuck it, I'm going to do this. I don't care. Here, he breaks one of the biggest rules of storytelling and fucking pulls it off and gets away with it in a way that I've never seen work before at this level. So we'll get into that in a minute. Then, of course, you've got William Lustig. And William Lustig, of course, not only did Maniac Cop and Maniac Cop 2 and Maniac Cop 3, he's also famous for Maniac.
Yes,
which
absolutely
was, of course, recently remade. And Maniac, of course, is sleazy. And Lustig is known for his particularly sleazy kind of grimy horror movies. But those aren't his best films. We're not talking about his best film tonight. In fact, I would say that we are probably in agreement on what his best film is.
Vigilante.
Yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. Which is another gem. So these guys did some of the great underappreciated genre stuff, junk food cinema classics. But this right here is both of their Star Wars. Like, this is their, they pulled out all the stops, they called in all their friends, yeah, they made something that you look at and you go, wait, this has Tom Atkins, Bruce Campbell, Richard Roundtree, and Robert Zadar in one little horror movie?
Yep.
Fuck yeah.
One stop shop. I mean, these guys here, I think Star Wars is an apt comparison in that this is the bargain basement Lucas Spielberg team up.
Yes.
This is the bargain basement version of that. And you know me, I am obsessed with, one of my favorite things, and one of the reasons why I do this show, is I'm obsessed with movies that take odd, absurd trajectories from inception to reality. And this movie absolutely is one of those cases where what happened was, actually, one of the first interviews I ever got to do was I interviewed William Lustig when the Draft House was doing a retrospective screening of, they were doing Vigilante, Maniac, and Maniac Cop 2.
I remember this because I got to meet Lustig as well in the oddest circumstances. I had just walked out of a movie and Zach from the Draft House walks out and he's like, oh, Cargill, I want to introduce you to someone. This is William Lustig, director of Maniac Cop 2.
Yes.
And I was like, oh, it's nice to meet you. And I was like, and through my head, I was like, why did he just say Maniac Cop 2 instead of why did he jump to 2? Like, it was such a wonderful Zach moment. Because Maniac Cop 2 is great and so very Zach. But it's like, he made 4 really good movies. So you were interviewing him.
So I was interviewing him, and one of the things I asked about was how the movie came about, Maniac Cop. And he said, at the time, you know, Maniac had been a pretty big hit for them. And Larry Cohen approached him about the idea of doing a sequel to Maniac. And he's like, I don't really think Maniac's the kind of movie that lends itself to a sequel. And at the time when they were talking about this, the biggest movies out were RoboCop, Beverly Hills Cop. So the whole cop, apparently Ronnie Cox, very big in this era because he's in both those movies.
Oh, yeah.
So this was a very big trend going on. So Larry Cohen's like, what about Maniac Cop? And then just came up with this tagline on the spot of, you have the right to remain silent forever. And Lustig looked at him and said, Larry, that's a movie. And so they had this conversation in February. And then in March, they have the big St. Patrick's Day parade in New York. Well, both of them kind of decided they wanted that to be a centerpiece of Maniac Cop, was this parade. So they didn't have a script, but they got Bruce Campbell. They gave him a little bit of money and had him fly out to New York and film these scenes at the parade that end up at the end of this film that we're going to talk about with no script. No, like, nothing but a tagline and a star, they end up kind of retroactively selling the movie based on that.
And get this, just to add a little extra fucking junk food cred to this goddamn movie, they had Bruce Campbell out there shooting. They got Bruce Campbell to call up one of his friends to do a cameo as a reporter.
Yep.
A little guy named
Sam Raimi.
Sam Raimi shows up. Like, it's a blink and you'll miss it cameo. Like, he literally is just there on screen for 5 seconds. I had to stop the movie and go, wait a second. That's not, skip back, that's Sam Raimi. And so I called my wife into the other room. I said, you got to see this. And she's like, wait, was that Sam Raimi? It's like, yes, it was. Yeah. So Sam Raimi is in New York City with Bruce Campbell shooting this scene for a movie they don't have a script yet.
Yes. And I remember in the interview saying, wow, that's kind of a Roger Corman approach to filmmaking. Start with the tagline and shoot around it. And he said, yeah, that he said that aspect was Roger Corman. That was AIP. But He said, I don't know if Roger Corman would have started a movie without a script, but we did. So basically saying, like, we may be more insane than Roger Corman, which I can't really argue with.
But the script was not slapdash. What they ended up with is something that's actually really fucking smart.
Yeah.
And works really well in terms of the relevance of it at the time, which, by the way, is extraordinarily relevant now. This is a movie that at its core, it's about people being afraid of the police.
Yes.
And there's a great sequence in there where they're
doing... This is the horror movie version of an NWA album.
To a certain extent, yeah. But it's also the very much a schlock version of Black Lives Matter. You know, there is a sequence where they're interviewing people on the street about cops.
Yeah, I noticed this too, and it kind of freaked me out a little bit. The one guy who's like... the black guy who's like, I've seen my friends get shot by cops. Yeah. In the back when they say they claim they have a gun when they don't. So, yeah, like, eerie relevant.
They saw something shiny.
Yeah.
And all these people talking about their bad experiences with the cops. They tied in the fear that we natively had of the police, especially during that era and in this era that we're going through again, and the distrust of police, and used that for what is ostensibly a fucking slasher film.
Yeah, and I feel like we need to start from the top here, because I know we talk about a lot of movies that I think are schlocky and fun or cheesy and weird, but a lot of them of that ilk I think many people have heard of. This one, probably less so. So I want to kind of start at the top. So this movie takes place in New York, and it starts with a waitress who's on her way home from work, and she gets assaulted by these two guys who are trying to steal her purse. She runs up to a police officer standing in the park. Oh, thank goodness you're here. That cop picks her up and snaps her neck. And so the eyewitnesses were the two muggers telling the police, no, the guy who did this is wearing a police uniform. And there is a detective, Lieutenant McCrae, played by Tom Atkins. Motherfucking Tom Atkins of Night of the Creeps and Halloween 3 and The Fog and...
Escape from New York.
Escape from New York. I mean, you name awesome in the 80s, it's going to have Tom Atkins in it. So he's told by his superiors, though, on the force, namely Commissioner Richard Roundtree.
Commissioner Shaft.
Commissioner Shaft, to suppress the details because they don't want it getting out that a cop is the one who did this. Now this
because he's a complicated man and no one understands him but his woman.
Are you talking about Shaft?
You can dig it.
I can dig it. Because by this point, by the time it gets there, there has been a second murder as well, also by a uniformed cop. Two young people are out and they're stopped at a light, and cop makes the guy get out of the car and ends up slashing his throat with one of the greatest crazy weapons in a slasher movie is the sword blade stuck in the nightstick.
Yeah.
I love that so much. So he's told to suppress the details, and instead of just sitting on it because he doesn't think it's the right thing to do to cover it up, he gives the information to a journalist friend of his, who basically like broadcasts it, and now people are paranoid of the police. And there's this great sequence where a woman gets pulled over and you think it's going to be another kill, and instead she pulls a gun and shoots just a regular cop who was trying to assist her when her car was broken down. So it really does play up that idea of people become paranoid of the police. And then we get introduced to Jack Forrest, played by Bruce Campbell, who at the beginning of this movie is having really severe like marital problems. Like it's like an Ibsen play starts up in the middle of our slasher movie.
Yeah, no, like it's very weird the way it's done, but it's clearly his wife is unhinged.
She's afraid of him. She says, I'm afraid of you.
Yeah.
Like you're very intense. You wake up screaming sometimes. I feel like I'm afraid of you. And he said he has to go out on patrol. She follows him because she actually thinks he might be the maniac cop.
Because somebody is calling her and telling her he is.
Yes, somebody keeps calling her and saying, he's going out again, isn't he? It's him, it's him. So she follows him, come to find out he is actually sleeping with another police officer, Teresa Mallory, played by Laureen Landon, who is another big name of the 80s. She's been in all kinds of schlocky stuff herself. So... She's all the wife, Victoria, I'm sorry, Ellen, the wife of Bruce Campbell's character, is distraught. She runs away, but then she's abducted and murdered herself, so the police automatically think that it is Bruce Campbell who's done it. Now, here's the interesting thing, and Cargill, I think this might be what you're talking about with the storytelling. Correct me if I'm wrong, but what's interesting about this slasher film is for a while, and this is kind of where this part reaches its apex, it's a genuine whodunit type of slasher movie, even though it's set up more like the Jason Voorhees type, you know, mindless slasher movie, because the way they filmed the murders thus far, they've all been dimly lit. They've all kind of shown the cop from the back, and the builds of Bruce Campbell and Robert Zadar, you know, from certain angles aren't terribly dissimilar.
No.
So they're actually setting up doubt in the audience that maybe that's exactly what this, maybe Bruce Campbell is the killer.
That's part of what I'm talking about.
Okay.
Because the thing is when I talk about how smart this script is, this is one of the elements. Like, they've set this up, and it is a whodunit. Mm-hmm. And it is functionally a Jason Voorhees movie.
Yes.
Functionally. But here's let me cut in with another thing here. Here's another thing that I'm just so amazed by with these movies. These movies, I don't believe, can exist outside of the vacuum of the 80s. I don't believe, not just that they couldn't be made any other time in the 80s, I don't believe that you can show these movies to 15-year-olds who have not grown up watching slasher films and of the 80s and have them totally wrap their mind around everything that's going on. Like, when you get to the end of the first movie, and you ask them what's going on, you have to understand, you have to be inundated with the mythology of slasher movies of the 80s, because this movie leans heavily on that to remain so lean.
Yes.
There is nothing in the first movie that tells you for certain that this guy is undead.
This is true.
It is a phrase that is never used. It is, you know, nobody even believes anything like that. They believe he is just a human being, but we are given three particular moments in the film that let anybody who's watched a slasher film or a couple of slasher films know, oh, this guy's not alive.
Yeah.
This guy's dead.
Well, I mean, for the beginning of the movie, we don't even know it's a separate guy from Bruce Campbell. Mm-hmm. Until a murder happens while he's in jail. Because what happens is, while Bruce Campbell's in jail, his alibi, basically for the reason he didn't kill his wife, means he has to out himself as having this affair with another
cop,
which is going to ruin her career. So he's like, you gotta admire Bruce Campbell's character, because even though he's facing facing a capital crime, he's like, I don't want to ruin her, so maybe they'll find the other guy before Friday, and I won't have to bring this up. So he's sitting in jail, and the maniac cop goes after Lorene Landon's character, who is undercover as a prostitute. Now, I want to say one thing about this scene. This is the first time in any movie I've ever seen the "Are you a cop?" to an undercover prostitute work out the way it's supposed to.
Yeah,
because she goes up to the car. He's like, "Hey, do you want to ride? Do you want a date?" And she's like,
"Can you be more specific?"
And he's like, "You wouldn't happen to be a cop, would you?" And she's like, "You asked the $1 million question. Go home to your wife and kids." I've never seen that happen that way that it's supposed to in a movie.
And it's a funny moment, because he's just like, "That's what I was planning on doing, but I'll think about you. I'll be thinking about you." And she goes, "No crime in that." Like, it's really this back and forth, "Fuck you, no fuck you," without being all "fuck you" about it. It's really amusing.
I really hope that her hooker name is Alexandra Graham Bell, because she could not have telegraphed more that she was a cop. It was ridiculous. Oh, she has to be the worst undercover hooker of all time. She's like, "Could you maybe be more specific?" She might as well have said, "Could you speak into the microphone?" Like, it was just like, come on. But it was just like, I've never seen that interaction go down exactly the way that it's intended to in any film before. So I thought that was interesting.
Yeah.
So she gets attacked by the maniac cop. By this point, Tom Atkins knows her identity, so he's trying to find her, happens to be there. The two of them fend him off, so she isn't murdered. But this is the point where we realize that it is a separate person from Bruce Campbell. And it's at this point that Tom Atkins discovers the files on a former police officer named Matt Cordell.
Well, before this, that scene, that's where we get one of those first moments. They fire the gun into him.
Yeah.
And he doesn't go down. And she swears she hit him in the head.
Yeah, that's the thing, is we don't see her hit him in the head, but she swears in the restaurant afterwards that she shot him at least twice in the head.
She also talks about something that will come up in the second film as well, that he feels as cold as ice.
Yes.
That he just feels cold.
Yeah, because he grabs her at one point.
Yeah, and these are two of the only clues we're given in this whole movie that he's dead.
Yeah. Well, and this is what's crazy, too, is like, because of the way it's structured, we don't even know that we're looking for clues for twists. We don't know that that's even something we need to look for.
Yeah.
Because we think this is just, oh, either it's Bruce Campbell or it's a Jason Voorhees. But there's a line of dialogue in this scene between her and Tom Atkins in the bar where he's like, who else did you tell? You must have told somebody. And she says, Sally Noland is the woman that works in the file room. She's got a brace on her leg. He's like, oh, yeah, it walks with a limp. So she's the only one you told. I'll talk to her. And that becomes such a big part of the mystery surrounding Matt Cordell, who he finds the files on. Now, Matt Cordell was a hero cop who was supposedly set up and sent to Sing Sing for
Well, yes and no. So here's the thing. We're talking about Maniac Cop.
Yeah.
In Maniac Cop, he is a guy who violated people's rights and was bumped off of the force for being too violent. He was shoot first, ask questions later. He was everybody's hero, but he was the Dirty Harry that went a step too far and ends up being prosecuted and sent to prison.
But here's what's interesting, is I realize what I say set up, I'm leaping ahead to stuff we don't find out until Maniac Cop 2.
Yes.
Whoops.
Because this is what I was talking about at the beginning. Like, literally, we are presented with one Matt Cordell in this movie that then branches out and gets more defined in the second movie, thus explaining what's really going on in the first movie.
Yeah.
Because what's really going on in the first movie is kind of even more fucked up than you think it is. Because in Maniac Cop, you are being presented with a character who was an evil guy using his place on the force to be violent. And then maybe he comes back from the dead and continues to be violent using being a cop. And right here at this moment that we're getting to is where we first start getting fleshed out who our killer really is and why this woman is helping him.
Yeah. So, yes. And that's really the crazy part, is like, we find out more about Matt Cordell. He ends up... this is what's crazy, because this part is played by Robert Zadar, is that he ends up getting murdered in the shower while in prison, which is basically what he tried to do to both Tango and Cash in Tango and Cash.
A year later.
So, yeah, Matt Cordell gets murdered and sliced up in Sing Sing. And that is
the only time we see his face until the third act of the second film.
Yes. And not only that, but it's one of the
you get a little bit in profile and from a distance in the final sequence of this movie.
Yeah.
But they do not show you what the Maniac Cop looks like. He is always in shadow. He is always from behind.
And they don't give you a good idea what he sounds like either, because his grunts in this scene sound like video game bosses. If you get a direct hit on them, it's like, it does not sound like a human at all. It's almost professing the idea that he is some kind of mutant before he's even murdered, which is interesting. So while Tom Atkins is investigating this, he ends up following Sally Noland out to this dock where he sees that she is talking to Matt freaking Cordell in his police uniform, and she's like, you know, you have to slow down. I gave you the people you needed to kill. Like, all of a sudden you realize she's basically feeding him names of people to kill.
Yeah.
And this is what's crazy about
it. But he's not killing the right people.
No, he's not killing the right people.
And she's distraught because she's like, I thought with us doing this, you were going to kill the pushers and you were going to kill the dealers. Like, I thought you were going to kill the bad guys like you used to.
Yeah.
But instead, he's killing innocent people, and she is distraught, but at the same time, she's trying to protect him.
Well, but here's the really crazy cool part of this story, is that she orchestrated the entire idea of framing Bruce Campbell for these murders.
Yep.
But why did she need to... She didn't need to do that, because, I mean, what you have here is basically an undead serial killer, and he's murdering... Like, basically, he ends up murdering for vengeance, but if that's the case, then... That was going to be long after Bruce Campbell was in prison. So the whole plan is really interesting to me, because she is going above and beyond what a typical slasher movie does, which is just kill everybody, don't worry about it, because I just live in the woods and who the hell's good. Like, there's never an issue of what if the cops find out I'm doing this. That is reserved for slasher movies where it's like, you know, your Scream or, you know, your movies where there is a human killer who's wearing a mask and stabbing people. That's the movies where you have these elaborate plans for how they're going to get away with it. She has an elaborate plan for how Matt Cordell, who is already dead according to everyone in the city, is going to get away with these murders.
Except that this is, again, this is one of the things that I think is so great about how lean and well constructed this is. There is a real reason why she's doing that. And that real reason is that the police know that someone inside is involved. And so she's not throwing them off his
scent. She's throwing them off her scent.
She's throwing them off her scent. Ah. And setting that up because Matt's still going to be Matt. And she's trying to contain him and control him. And she can't. But they know that they've figured out that he's getting inside information. And so she is now throwing them a bone and giving them their killer. Ostensibly to keep her able to help Matt, to keep Matt going.
Yeah, no, that's very true. So we go on from there, and what ends up happening is Tom Atkins gets really close to identifying that Sally is the one behind this. She flips out and attacks him, but by this point, Matt Cordell's already in the building and has basically made this jailhouse look like a haunted house because there are just bodies hanging everywhere that are like swinging out at the approach. This becomes like the third act of every Friday the 13th movie where the bodies are being discovered. It's just like, boom, everything is dead. Everyone is dead. The very awkward kill of Sally where she's basically pressed against a wall to death. Like I don't know if he's trying to like dispel a static charge through her. I don't know what he's doing. But in his efforts to save Sally, Tom Atkins unfortunately gets thrown out of a window.
And here's what I was talking about. Tom Atkins, up until this point in the movie, he's our protagonist.
Yeah.
We've had four scenes in total up until this point at 58 minutes into the movie. We have only had four scenes with Bruce Campbell in it. That's it.
Yeah.
We have him and his wife. We have him in bed. We have him getting arrested, being told his wife is dead and being thrown in jail, and then him being interrogated. The rest of the movie is all Tom Atkins investigating this crime. He is our protagonist. And then he is thrown out a window to his death.
It's like that Friday the 13th remake where you think that one girl is going to be the final girl, and then like right before the end, she gets a machete through the heart, and you're like, oh, well, shit. I guess she's not the final girl.
It's more like the brilliance of the opening of the original Nightmare on Elm Street. But even that, we only spend 2 minutes with the girl we think is our protagonist. And then another.
And those 2 minutes are at the very beginning.
And then all the rest of the time, we're also spending with Nancy. We're just not focused on Nancy. We think Nancy's the best friend, not the protagonist. But even then, that flip happens in the first 10 minutes of the movie. Like, that's our, you know, our inciting incident. This is at minute 58 that Tom Atkins, our protagonist, is thrown out the window. And we as the audience aren't bothered by that. Like, we're sad that he's gone, but it's not the moment. Like, with the new Nightmare on Elm Street, they played with that and they killed our protagonist just at the end of the first act. And then shifted protagonists. There's another movie, a horror movie that came out a few years ago. I think it's called Home, in which every 30 minutes our protagonist gets killed and gets replaced by a new protagonist. And you get audiences disconnect. You disconnect and you're like, oh, now I've got to learn about somebody else and care about somebody else. But what they've already done is through these four scenes, they've made us care about Bruce Campbell so much that when it's Bruce Campbell trying to get Matt Cordell now instead of Tom Atkins, you're in. Yeah. You are fucking in and you are following along and it's like, holy fuck, we lost our good guy. Good thing we have another good guy. And this, by the way, is the hallmark of the Maniac Cop series. The Maniac Cop series becomes a series of characters that you connect with, that you really like, that are the good guys that keep getting offed by the bad guy.
Yeah.
Like that's just how it keeps happening. Like, if you can survive two Maniac Cop movies, nobody does.
Nobody does
survives two Maniac Cop movies. You have
a better chance of making it out of Game of Thrones than making it out of a Maniac Cop movie.
Yes, and that's what's so fascinating is how well this movie does this and how well Cohen and Lustig establish these characters, make us like them, cast wonderful B-movie, pulpy, awesome actors who can connect with an audience in 5 minutes, give them good, solid characters with real motivations.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, the wonderful bit of the opening, it's something you never see in cop movies, and it's just so great, is, you know, we have the detective called into the office or into the morgue, mm-hmm. and one guy's like, hey, will you cover her up? You know, hey, why are you chasing after a cop for this? And then he goes, do you know who this girl was? She's a waitress in a bar.
Oh, yeah, he's got, like, she was funny.
She always had the latest jokes.
She should audition for one of those comedy shows.
Yeah, I'd go in this bar for a nightcap. I'm going to get whoever got this fucking girl. Like, right there, you're like, this guy's a sad mess, and we find out later in the worst piece of dialogue in this movie, like laugh out loud bad, just how fucked up he is. But in being fucked up, he commiserated with this girl who gets killed at the beginning of the movie, and that drives him. And then we learn throughout the movie, through his 58 minutes of existence, that this is a cop who's dedicated to justice.
Yeah.
And he doesn't care about the reputation of the cops. He cares about being the good guy. And then we also learn from Bruce Campbell that Bruce Campbell is a guy willing to sacrifice his own reputation for a while to protect this woman that he loves and that he cares about and not ruin her career. And all of the Maniac Cop movies are filled with these well-intentioned, good people fighting the system against a villain who we will ultimately learn is fighting the system. Like, it is such a fascinating dynamic, and we connect to these characters so well through this dynamic that here we are now in the last half hour of this movie, and we have a new protagonist, and we're in it to win it. Like, we are going to watch fucking Bruce Campbell versus Maniac Cop, and it is fucking great.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. And I don't know if this is the line you're talking about, but I know my favorite line from Tom Atkins in this movie is when he's talking to the reporter and she's like, well, why are you giving me this information? Why do you think it's best to just let this out on the news? And he says something effective. You know how this goes. We're not going to get any attention unless we make this bigger than AIDS. And I was just like, what the fuck? Like, make it bigger than AIDS. At the height of the AIDS crisis, they have a line in this movie where he's basically like, we have to make this news story bigger than AIDS if anyone's going to care. And it's just like,
no,
shit.
No, no, no. I'm talking about the line where just out of the blue, Richard Roundtree goes, hey, by the way, didn't you try to shoot yourself?
Oh, yeah. And he's like, the gun went off.
Yeah. And it's
the gun,
like,
went off.
Yeah. Like that it's like the one of the worst segues in history. It's just like, oh, hey, by the way, we forgot we have to deepen your character a little and make you a little fucked up. So I'm just going to mention that out of the blue while we're having this discussion. And it's just it's ham-fisted in a way that the rest of this movie isn't. So it sticks out like a sore thumb.
And this is a real hold on to your hat moment, because that actually ties in to something with the protagonist in Maniac Cop 2.
Yep.
So just kind of put that under your hat for now. But we haven't even talked about one of my favorite characters in this whole movie, who is played by another amazing B-movie actor by the name of William Smith, who plays Captain Ripley in this movie.
Oh, Will Smith.
Yeah. Woo! No, he's not getting jiggy with it. He's actually... He reminds me a lot of Joe from Reservoir Dogs in this movie. He's real gruff, he's real in your face, and he's got a voice like if you threw a bag of car keys into a dryer, like that's what it would sound like. That's
the whole time he's kind of talking like this.
I don't know what you're talking about.
He sounds like you with laryngitis being throat fucked by Tom Waits. Yeah, that's kind of...
that's a sentence that just happened.
That is a sentence that just happened. You can go ahead and put that on a t-shirt. Throat fucked by Tom Waits. William Smith plays Bruce Campbell's captain. And there's this great scene where they think Bruce Campbell's the killer, and they pull him out of like the morning lineup. And he's just talking to his captain like, hey, did you decide where you're going to retire and all this other stuff? And he's like, William Smith, you get the sense that they have never been... like close. It's not that kind of like superior subordinate relationship. It's just like instantly like, you need to call that lawyer and I need to read you your Miranda rights, and you know. And then when he and Tom Atkins are interrogating him together, it's just all this reams. And this is actually where I think the script is really smart, is there are all of these reams of shit that if you are a reasonable thinking person in the world of this movie, of course you would suspect that it was Bruce Campbell. He's always going out at night. He doesn't give the alibi yet. He's having trouble with his wife. There is a scrapbook in their house full of clippings of the maniac cop's murders. Like, yeah, of course they think it's him. And they know that someone, whoever's doing these killings, has information from the inside. Like, all roads seem to lead to
ambush.
Yes. This is what I'm saying. So William Smith, though, is just throughout this movie such a goddamn prick. But not in the sense that you think that he's on the wrong side of the law. He's just an asshole. And I've seen William Smith play so many villains that this felt really refreshing in that he's still a dick, but he's a dick for the right reasons. And the scene where he and Richard Roundtree get murdered pretty much at the exact same time as they're waiting for an elevator, it was just like, well, going to tie up this loose end pretty nicely, because as we unravel the mythos of Matt Cordell, you start to realize that pretty much everybody was either behind or instrumental in his downfall, and he is not taking too kindly to it. No. In which case, it becomes more of the giallo influence slashers of the early 80s, where it's like, someone's done me wrong, I will come back from the grave to make sure that they pay for it. And then on top of that, I want to talk about one thing we haven't mentioned yet, we'll definitely talk more about in the second movie.
In the second part.
In
Junk Food Cinema, the sequel.
Dun, dun, dun. Are the stunts, because the stunts in these movies are fantastic.
There's one stunt in this movie at the very end, the very last stunt of the movie, that you're just like, oh my God, somebody could have died. Like, it's one of those like pre-CG stunts that you were just like, you watch, you're just like, holy fuck.
Yeah.
How did that stuntman not die? Like, that's brilliant stunt work. It's either brilliant stunt work or life is cheap stunt work. Like, it's like that stunt reminded me a lot of the Born to Fight stunt, where the guy gets thrown off of the
and almost gets crushed by the semi. Yeah, actually, it was funny. I was watching this and I had that same feeling of, how did someone not die? And I was like, that's how I felt watching Mad Max Fury Road. Like, to the point that I expect. So what happens is, I expected a doof warrior to come flying in playing a guitar behind them. But this police truck with Bruce Campbell holding onto the side, being driven by Matt Cordell, goes careening off a dock. And the stuntman who was holding onto the side gets flipped completely upside down. But the two objects, the stuntman and this giant steel police van, are falling very close proximity to one another into the water, to the point that you're like, that's going to land on that guy and kill him. Like, there's no way that's not going to land on the guy. It is outrageously dangerous looking, but they pull it off. And it's so awesome.
Yeah.
It is so fucking fantastic.
Yeah, and they do a really great job of these kills without showing Zadar.
Yes.
You know, while keeping him out of frame, but still making these kills look very real and well done. Like, it's really well executed for the level of budget this movie is clearly operating on.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's one of the things is, I feel like this movie, by the time it gets around to showing you sort of the undead Zadar, it looks like, I mean, Robert Zadar is a striking individual, or was, unfortunately, he's passed away, was a very striking individual just in his physical presence. But when you add to that this makeup that makes it look like he got in a fight with Wolverine, like his face is just all mangled and cut up, like it really is kind of an unsettling thing to look at.
And you don't really get to see that till the second movie.
Well, you see it a little bit at the very end, but it's like, yeah, it's just a glimpse. And I think a lot of that comes from, A, the fact that they were setting up this doubt in the audience mind if it could be Bruce Campbell doing it. But then too, yes, I think the budget that they were operating on and recognizing those limitations and kind of jawsing the situation. Where it's
exactly.
Like, no,
and that's what I think more of it is they keep the maniac cop a shadowy, scary, lurking fucking hulk of a Frankenstein figure without, you know, needing to rely on it.
And if you look at the poster for the movie, I mean, like it's a cop whose face you can't see in the dark. I mean, that's absolutely what they were going for. But you, on all this, on top of the fact that you have this score that has this weird kind of chimey, whistly, I mean, it sounds like this. Yeah, I mean, that it's like this otherworldly type, you know,
it's just very
tones.
Yeah, it's, you know, the toy piano out of tune. There's kind of a very poltergeisty feel to it to a certain degree.
Yeah.
It's very of its time and yet haunting. Like, it's really, really well done theme for a monster. Like, it might be one of my favorite themes for a single slasher monster ever created. Like, you know, Jason has the several of the other themes, just none of them for the various slashers. Nobody really kind of created a went the full route of like the John Williams of creating a, you know, the whole Peter and the Wolf, I'm creating a theme for everyone kind of concept, and did that with a slasher that was as effective as this. And the way it's used in these movies, it's so special, and it just really kind of nails the mood of Maniac Cop, who is scary, terrifying, but also sad and tragic.
Oh, yeah.
Like, he's a tragic monster, especially when you get into the second movie, which we will do next week.
I do want to point out one thing. There is a scene that was cut. It's in the extended cut of this movie, which, by the way, Synapse put out a beautiful Blu-ray of this movie several years ago that you should definitely check out and pick up. But there's in the extended cut, there's a scene in which a character, and I understand now, and again, this all goes back to what we were saying about how the second one really enhances and extends the mythos of Matt Cordell. There's a scene where the mayor, played by popular character actor Ken Lerner, is playing the mayor, and he's at the end of the movie relaxing because he thinks Cordell is gone, and then Cordell comes out from behind a curtain and murders the mayor. So, I mean, you have to understand that Matt Cordell is like the Joker of this New York Gotham City. He's killed the commissioner, the mayor, and he does it all while dressed as a cop. So he is the fucking Joker.
Yeah, and he's got, you know, the only information we have is that he's pissed off that these people railroaded him, that they betrayed him and put him away. And in this film, what you were led to believe was he is a violent cop who they put away.
Deserved to be put away, but then was also murdered. So, yeah, you're right. In this film, it's more of a, yeah, we can't really have people like that out on the streets. Like, he deserved to go to jail.
So you,
it's unfortunate what happened to him, but maybe the revenge is just because he's an evil dude.
But everyone in this film that is one of these characters is playing it in a way as if there's more to it than that. Like, this is one of those things that when you get to the second film, I don't think this is a retcon. I don't think this is we got another idea later. I think this was kind of the concept all along, and they wanted to leave some stuff open to play around with in a second film. And then they did.
Yeah.
And they create a perfectly bookended two-film arc.
Yeah. No, absolutely they did. And I feel like it's one of those situations where, you know, very much like the good franchises, you could have ended this movie. You could have been satisfied with the ending you got at the end of this movie. But once the second movie starts, and we'll get to that next week, you realize just how integral to each other these movies are and how much fun you have double featuring them. Again, I think the Godfather like saga cut is a really apt analogy because, yeah, you piece those things together and you realize how certain things that seemed buried within the separate movies actually fit together really well.
Yeah, and the second movie picks up just a few months after the first one with our protagonists from the end of the first movie. And we'll get into that next week.
Yes, absolutely. So definitely check out Maniac Cop. It is a slasher unto itself.
By the way, if for some reason you have gotten this far and listened and have not watched Maniac Cop yet, it's available for free right now on Shudder.
Oh, there you go.
So if you have not checked out Shudder yet and you are a junk food fan, which if you've gotten this far in one of our episodes, I'm guessing you are, Shudder is an all-horror streaming service that I absolutely love. It's always been tough for me and my wife. My wife is a huge horror movie buff, and some nights we'll be sitting up having a bottle of wine, laying in bed, and she'll be like, I want to watch a horror movie. And I'm like, I don't know what you haven't seen at this point, because we've watched most of them. And so what we do now is we hop on Shudder and we just start flipping through, and you can choose what kind of monster you want to watch by. You can choose by theme. They've always got something streaming for free that something streaming on the channel that you just kind of pop it on and go, oh, what's this? And you watch a few minutes like, oh, I kind of want to watch this. But yeah, so Maniac Cop is available right now on Shudder. So if you haven't tried out Shudder yet, try it out. Check out Maniac Cop.
So Shudder and Synapse, enjoy your free plugs, as neither one of you are sponsoring this episode.
No.
But you are both great places to watch Maniac Cop. By the way, another eerie relevance thing I want to talk about watching this movie right now is that New York had its own actual Maniac Cop not too long ago. The cop who was accused of killing and cooking a bunch of women, he was dubbed the Cannibal Cop.
I was not.
Did you not? Did you not hear about this?
No.
So his conviction was overturned in December of last year. So this fucking guy is out, and he's accused of literally killing and eating people. Like, that to me, like, you can't make shit up in this movie freakier than what happens in real life. And speaking of real life, you may have heard also that they are remaking Maniac Cop. It is going to be produced by Nicholas Winding Refn, and I have to tell this quick story. He was in town for a junket for Only God Forgives, and I don't know how I got there, but I ended up at this speakeasy in East Austin with Nicholas Winding Refn. We're talking about 80s movies we love, and we talked at length, and I was so excited that he loved this movie as much as I did, Maniac Cop. So to hear that he's producing the remake is absolutely fantastic news, and it's actually being directed by John Hyams, son of Peter Hyams, who John Hyams also did what I thought was the really good reboot of the Universal Soldier, the first Universal Soldier movie he made, which I believe is called Regeneration, which is actually really good. It's a tiny microscopic budget movie, but it brings back Jean-Claude Van Damme and Dolph Lundgren, and they are way better in that movie than either one of them are in any of the Expendables movies. So I'm excited to see what they do with it. But William Lustig is also producing. So Lustig and Refn are producing. Ed Brubaker is going to write it, and John Hyams is going to direct it. So I'm pretty excited to see what that looks like.
You can fight him. Remain silent forever.
So that brings us to the junk food pairing, and I had to go with a favorite decadence of mine. And that is the Voodoo Donut. Now, this is a chain that there is one here in Austin. I know there's one out in Portland. They're starting to spring up all over the place. But Voodoo Donut prides itself on taking a tried and true staple of pigging out. And when I say pigging out, I mean that in a double entendre sort of way, because it's also the chief snack of the police force, the famously known...
Wait, police like donuts?
Police like donuts, unless you're Sergeant Al Powell, and then you just like Twinkies. But most cops love donuts.
And well, his wife is pregnant.
Yeah, sure, bag it. So the great thing about Voodoo Donut is they take the basic concept of a donut, and they jam so much absurd but delicious elements onto the donut until it is an absolute monstrosity that you can't help but love. They have donuts with Fruit Loops on them. They have donuts with bacon on them. They have donuts with Cocoa Puffs on them. They have so many bizarre, monstrous, Frankenstein-type donuts that I couldn't help but think as I was watching this movie that not only is a cop's favorite snack a donut, but I feel like the hideously deformed Frankenstein's monster that is Matt Cordell would appreciate being able to snarf something down that, much like this movie, isn't content just being average, isn't content being a standard slasher movie, but has to throw a lot of things on top of it that you would never in a million years think to put on the donut or on the slasher movie to make it truly hideous and truly amazing. And that is why the Voodoo Donut is my junk food pairing for Maniac Cop. Nothing? Wow. No resistance from Cargo this
week. I was just going to say, it's also probably, Robert Zadar is probably the only person in history that could eat, you know, fit one of those in his mouth in one bite.
In one bite, yes. R.I.P. R.I.P. Robert Zadar. Well, thank you so much for joining us this week on Junk Food Cinema. Join us next week when, why even try and hide at this point? We've told you 1,000 times.
Maniac Cop 2!
Maniac Cop 2 will be our main course next week. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema, or like us on Facebook, facebook.com/Junk Food Cinema. Rate and review us on iTunes or check us out on Stitcher. And please check out that Patreon page. We will have a link here below. And yeah, we really do appreciate any support we can get there to help us, you know, keep the lights going here. It's a lot of work that we put into this, and we really appreciate anything that you can spare. Yeah, Cargill, where can people find you online?
Find me at facebook.com/massiveworm. That's MASSAWYRM. Or at Twitter, twitter.com/massiveworm.
All right. You can find me on Twitter at Bri Guy Salisbury, or on Facebook, my page, facebook.com/Brian Salisbury Critic. And yeah, just join us here next week and keep checking out the goings on here at filmschoolrejects.com. And until next week, I want to remind you that you have the right to remain silent
forever.